Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The stock market is surging. The S&P up 45% in the last year. The NASDAQ now up 70% from its 2003 low. The Dow touched a 22-month high yesterday. Once-burned investors are bullish again. But how does the hot market square with those big deficits and feeble job creation? And will it outlast the November presidential election? Tonight on Point, what's driving the market and how far can it go? But first, the wage gap between America's high and low earners is widening again as the job market remains weak and technology and foreign labor erode the bargaining power of low-paid workers. Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him what is happening to American wages.
What's basically been happening is that in the last 3 years, the people who are at the bottom of the wage scale, people earning about, you know, 200, 300 bucks a week, they've really made no real progress at all compared to inflation. Whereas the people at the top of the wage scale, people making, say, $1,000, $1,500 a week, are doing actually quite well. They've had annual gains in the area of around 2% for each of the last 3 years. So there's been a widening between the top and the bottom, which is sort of what you would expect when the economy is in really bad shape, because essentially what we had in the late 90s was the opposite picture. We had the lowest unemployment rates in a generation, and this enabled people who had basically the least to bargain with in terms of skills and education the chance to actually get better wages from their employers, and we've essentially lost all that.
But this new growth in wage inequality is part of a long-term trend. It was interrupted in the late 1990s when the economy was so hot, but what is driving this inequality long-term, Greg?
That's right, Tom. The movement towards greater inequality really began in the 1970s, and there are several factors at play. One is probably technological change, because what essentially happens is that as the computers and the machines get better, they replace workers with few skills, and the ones who get to use the machines actually become more productive and they get paid better. Trade and globalization probably also has an effect, because a lot of the routine factory jobs that used to be done here in the United States can now be done at a fraction of the wage in other countries. And, of course, there's immigration, especially illegal immigration, which tends to compete with some of the people at the low end of the wage scale. And finally, there are institutional factors. The decline of unions is almost certainly at play here, because unions do tend to try and raise wages across the board for everybody who's unionized, regardless of how much education they have. And, of course, the minimum wage hasn't gone up in 7 years.
Now, in these numbers, when you look at the lower wage earners and higher wage earners, not included here are the super returns or compensation packages of the big CEOs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Tom. I mean, you get a completely different picture when you look at all forms of income, not just weekly salaries and wages. If you look at the impact of taxes and things like stock options and so on, that can change the picture quite a lot. In the late 90s, there were just like outsized, gigantic packages being awarded to executives that were completely disconnected from the performance they were delivering. And a lot of that, of course, has gone away since we've had all the scandals and the stock market bust of recent years.
But you're saying that in these Labor Department numbers, that's not even a factor.
That's right.
Those are sliced off the top, and it's just strong wage earners, not ecstatic super wage earners.
Exactly, Tom. What you're seeing here, in my opinion, is really the effect of a long-term economic gravity, not just the egregious greed of the late 90s.
Who's really bearing the brunt of this at the losing end of the wage gap, Greg?
One of the most striking pieces of evidence is that the young are especially hard hit. People aged 16 and 24 have really been losing ground in recent years, and while people over the age of 25 have not done too badly. And in some sense, that's also to be expected in a weak job market, because the people entering the workforce with the least experience, the least skills, will again have the least bargaining power, and they're competing against each other for the very few jobs that are available.
So the young are losing. Who else?
Men are losing ground, actually. Men have basically made no real gains in the last 3 years based on their median weekly paycheck.
And you're talking here about men at the low end of the wage range?
All men.
Wow.
If you look at the median paycheck of all male workers, it's really not gone up in the last 3 years.
Is it still ahead of women's?
It is still higher than women, but women are slowly catching up. And I think part of this factor relates to what I said earlier about the decline of the factory sector and of the union sector, because those have traditionally been places where men who did not have a lot of education and a lot of skills could get a well-paying job.
So remind us again then, how much are the higher-end wages going up and how stagnant are the low wages?
If you look at the top 10%, Tom, in other words, if you consider the worker who makes more than 90% of all other workers.
And what sort of annual salary would that be these days?
That would be about $75,000.
Okay, $75,000 and up.
Yeah, a nice wage, but not outrageous by any means. His salary went up about 1.8% in the fourth quarter of last year from a year earlier.
Okay.
And on average, it's gone up, I think, about 1.5% in each of the last 3 years.
And at the other end?
It's basically been zero. It went up a little bit last year, but that only made up for losses in prior years. So, in fact, over the last 3 years, it's essentially unchanged.
So if you're at the bottom of the wage scale, you're going nowhere. What are the political implications of this gap, Greg Ip?
The Democrats, you'll hear, are trying to really make hay of the fact that the average working class family is not really doing very well right now. There's been a lot of attention to the lack of jobs, the so-called jobless recovery, but not nearly as much attention to how well are the people who do still have jobs doing. And I think this kind of data underscores the point that some of the Democratic nominees have been trying to make, which is that the lower income earner has really suffered in recent years, and they are trying to make hay out of the fact that Bush's tax cuts did tend to divert even more of the income in this country towards the wealthier as opposed to the poorer family. Now, Bush's response to this, it's not so much to directly address the issue of inequality per se, but to say that what you want, if you're worried about people at the low end of the income earnings scale, is the ability to give them the skills and the productivity so they can move into the higher demand jobs where they can earn more money. So in his State of the Union speech, you heard him announce more money for community colleges, for example. But, you know, the evidence is not really that strong that a lack of education is behind this problem.
At least one Democratic candidate was talking about some significant change on the economic front today. Howard Dean talking about Alan Greenspan.
Yeah, it's interesting. Most people, most politicians, Democrats and Republicans, have for years praised Greenspan's handling of the economy. But today you actually heard Howard Dean say that he thinks Greenspan has become too political and should not have backed President Bush's tax cuts in 2001. And that raises the question that if Dean became president, whether, in fact, Greenspan would remain as chairman. It's a little bit moot, you know, in a way, because Bush has already said that he will reappoint Greenspan in June of this year when his term expires. But then in 2006, Greenspan's separate term as a governor, not as a chairman, expires, and the law says he can't be reappointed. So I'm not sure that this matters for a lot. But it is kind of interesting that there are some credible political leaders out there who are beginning to question the halo around Alan Greenspan.
We'll expect to hear a lot more about income inequality in the campaign season ahead. Greg Ip, thanks so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ip covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. The stock market is surging on news of strong corporate profits. The economy grew at a sizzling 8.2% in the third quarter last year. Interest rates are low, and housing prices just keep rising. In an election year, this is great news for President Bush, except that it's not the whole picture. The weak job market has not responded to the recovery, and long-term, growing deficits could squash economic growth and bring the market down with it. Tonight on Point, the soaring stock market in a big election year and what's fueling the surge. Are you back on the stock market bandwagon? How far can it roll this time? Is there a bubble again already? And do Wall Street and Main Street intersect anymore? Or are the Democrats right when they argue that Main Street has been left out of the party? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He's author of Stocks for the Long Run and Revolution on Wall Street. Good evening and welcome, Professor Jeremy Siegel.
Good evening, Tom.
It's great to have you back with us.
Thank you very much.
Joining us from Tucson, Arizona is Richard Silla, professor of economics at New York University's Stern School of Business and research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He is author of The American Capital Market, 1846 to 1914, and A History of Interest Rates. Good evening and welcome, Professor Richard Silla.
Tom, good to be here.
It's great to have you both. A lot to talk about tonight in this market and all the things that surround it, but I want to get your kind of starting positions right off the bat. Jeremy Siegel, you've watched this big new run-up in the market over the last 10 or 12 months. What do you think of it? Is it justified, and does it have legs? Can it go on?
Yes, I do believe it is justified. You mentioned we have strong economic growth. Certainly last quarter was great. This quarter, next quarter are predicted to be strong. We have the environment of low interest rates. Fed is committed to stay low. Inflation is low. And I think the job picture will turn around. I don't think it's as dismal as these labor market reports have been saying, and we can talk about that later.
1,000 jobs created in, was it December? That sounded pretty feeble for a country the size of this one.
It did, but if you looked at another survey called the Household Survey, we produced almost a million jobs. There's two different surveys giving very different results, and there's more and more economists are beginning to question whether this payroll number is as reliable as it has been in the past.
Now, that's fascinating. We'll have to come back to that. But Richard Cilla, let's get your starting position here. You've watched the market run up, too. Very big gains. People who are deeply in the market feeling terrific. People not in it, not sharing the party. But is it sustainable?
Well, I agree a lot with what Jeremy said, but I'm a little more worried about the sustainability factor because I think, you know, we've had expansive fiscal policy, expansive monetary policy. The dollar has weakened, which has actually helped the U.S. a little bit. And, you know, I think this is what's behind the turnaround in the economy, and it probably will begin to create jobs pretty soon. But I think, you know, this year may be an all right year, but after the elections, there's a kind of pattern of things don't seem quite so good. The administration, I think, may be hyping up the economy a little bit, and they may have to reverse course on some after the elections. So right now, I think the picture is looking pretty good, but I'd really worry about the 2005.
Jeremy Siegel, what about this, I don't know, the political face of this? How much capacity does this administration, any administration, have to pump up the stock market? And do you see that going on? And is it being done in a way that's legitimate and credible or political and will go away, you know, after the November election?
Well, you know, I hear Richard, and Richard is right. The year after the presidential election is usually not a very good year. The fourth year is a good year, which is what we're in now. The third year, which we just completed, is historically the best year. And it's interesting that this historical pattern has certainly played out recently.
Sure did.
But to answer your question, we've had a dose of fiscal stimulus, certainly by the Bush tax plan. I think most importantly has been Greenspan and the low interest rates. If you're asking me the primary reason why the economy is growing and the stock market is doing so well and housing is doing so well, I think it's Alan Greenspan more than President Bush.
And Richard Cilla, today, David Walker, U.S. Comptroller General, made a blistering attack on the nation's growing deficit. I guess it was yesterday that he did. He said it's undermining the future of the nation, putting an all but intolerable tax burden on future generations. He said, quote, the path we are on is imprudent and unsustainable. But yet the market roars on. I mean, it's back a little this week, but it's still just going like gangbusters.
Well, I think the deficits are high now, but the economy hasn't created all the jobs we want. So I think one could make a good economic argument for running deficits right now.
Mm-hmm.
But these deficits are partly caused by the big tax cuts that President Bush gave us back in 2001. And I think there are some longer-term problems. You know, the baby boomers are going to retire, and we have to pay them Social Security and Medicare. And so, I mean, there are some longer-run fiscal problems, but the politicians, I think, are looking as far ahead as the next election.
And you heard Howard Dean today, or heard the report. He's gone after Alan Greenspan, saying he's become too political in not being more critical of the deficits and tax cuts, and he needs to go. Those are kind of boat-rocking words, though, as Greg Ipp said, Alan Greenspan is not around forever anyway. How much does it matter? How important is Alan Greenspan to the whole picture at this point?
Well, I think Alan Greenspan has done a great job. So did his predecessor, Paul Volcker, back in the 1980s. And, it's an election year. Certainly, Howard Dean would, you know, prefer that the economy weren't doing quite so well now because that would give the Democrats a bigger issue. I think Alan Greenspan has done a great job. He's like anyone else, you know, his behavior should be examined. He is about 76 or 77 years old, so he certainly isn't going to go on forever. But I think what Mr. Dean said was much more politics than economics or political economy.
Richard Silla, Jeremy Siegel, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the surging stock market in a hot election year. Are you back in the stock market? Do Wall Street and Main Street intersect these days? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the surging stock market and the U.S. economic outlook in a hot election year. My guest tonight, Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, author of Stocks for the Long Run and Revolution on Wall Street. And joining us tonight from Tucson, Arizona, Richard Silla, professor of economics at NYU's Stern School of Business. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you back on the stock market bandwagon? Are you bullish again or afraid of another bubble? Have you put the family nest egg back in the market, or is it still under your mattress? And is the run-up for real, or is it a fleeting facet of George W. Bush's re-election bid? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeremy Siegel, I wish you'd walk us through, and I realize it's a little different for every company, of course, but the fundamentals here. We saw the huge valuations in the late 90s and then the huge crash. What is it in terms of what's going on in the business world that's justifying the new run-up?
Well, I think you're asking a very good question, and I think it's very important for listeners to realize that the bubble is really concentrated in the technology sector. It's really quite remarkable. If you just take out those tech companies, and you know, in the S&P 500, which is the most well known of all the indices, there's about 80 of them.
You mean take them out of the 90s bubble?
If you take them out of the index, mm-hmm. And you follow the other 420, we are now actually just at the level we were in March of 2000, which means that basically it was a bubble focused on technology, the internet, the excitement, the Y2K spending, yep. Or the end of the millennia, as some people say, just generated that. That popped. Then came Enron, and are these earnings really there or not? And yes, there are some bad CEOs, but fortunately, it isn't spread, it isn't endemic, and that's what has given the confidence to come back, as well as the fact that GDP is now growing at a healthy clip, and as we look back, this was one of the mildest recessions that we've suffered in the post-war period.
So I want to be sure I understand what you mean. When you talk about the tech stocks and the bubble, do you mean the 90s bubble, or do you see a bubble again? NASDAQ up 70% from its low last year nearly.
You're right. I am concerned about tech stocks. I think they have run ahead of themselves at this point. And I myself, for instance, am intending to avoid those again. We are not at the bubble stage. We are not anywhere near as severely overvalued as we were at the end of the 90s. But they now have some very high valuations. I think the rest of the market is quite fairly valued with respect to the prospects.
Richard Silla, how about your view here? We talked about, and we'll talk more about some of the economic context that could threaten this market. But within the run-up that we've seen, what looks solid to you? What might not look so solid?
Well, I think the big company stocks are looking good. You know, they're taking advantage of productivity, and that has to do with some of the investments that were made back in the bubble days. I guess I'm perhaps not even as worried as Jeremy about the NASDAQ, because remember, it fell from more than 5,000 down to just a little bit above 1,000. Mm-hmm. So, that, you know, the nearly, 75% drop.
And it closed today at 2,200 now, something like that?
Something above 2,000 anyway. So, I mean, it's had a tremendous gain from its lows, but it's still, you know, not much more than 40% of its peak. So, I think the peak was tremendously exaggerated. The last 1,000 points happened from November 99 to March 2000. So, but I think the prospects for some of those companies are pretty good. But you know, the run up, my view basically is that the rapidity of the run up so far makes me less optimistic about the outlook for this year and, of course, even worse for 2005.
Jeremy Siegel, do we have a sense of who's back in the market and who's not? I mean, I see general confidence out there. Business Week had its year-end survey of investors and people in the market. Of those in the market, 67% expected stocks to go up again in the coming year. But compared to the 1990s, let's say, do we know who's in and who's not?
Well, we know that most people in retirement plans, 401k, have generally stuck with stocks. They may have backed away a little bit. What we see really is, of course, all those people that were in the internet stocks and the day trading and all that has definitely calmed down. Although, by the way, there's still a very active sector still there. In some sense, I think the individuals have stayed with stocks, not gone overboard. I think some of the professionals got scared away. You know, the rise of hedge funds and, you know, a lot of people with a lot of money say, I don't want to touch the market and, you know, I want to go into alternative assets. And we've seen a boom of these alternative asset areas, while many of the traditional investors have stuck with stocks and bonds as part of their portfolio.
Let me ask you this, Jeremy Siegel. If an investor at the end of 99 or early 2000 had been in the market, let's say in index funds, so that he or she had been exposed hypothetically to the whole market, if they'd been in then and they'd taken those losses but stayed in, where would they be today? Have they recovered? Are they still shy of where they were? Are they ahead?
Well, if you were in, for instance, the S&P 500 index funds, which are, you know, the biggest stocks, about 80% of the market, you're still down. You're probably still down around 20%. I think that hit a high of 1550. You probably have where we closed maybe at 1130 or 1140 today.
So you're down in spite of this 40-50% run-up of the
right.
S&P.
Right. You are still down. What is very interesting is if you were in the smaller stocks or even the mid-caps, they are now back at their all-time highs. So if you stay with the smaller in this particular case, and doesn't always work this way, you're doing fine. The large stocks, you're right, on the index are down to about 20%, but certainly better than the 50% that we were in October of 2002. So we've enjoyed a run-up and wiped out more than, you know, half the losses of the bear market.
But if you stayed in, you still got half your losses sitting on your shoulder.
You still have half of them, but you remember we're measuring them from a
very high
overly
point.
High point that we all agree on wasn't justified in March of 2000.
Right. Richard Silla, we read a couple of weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal an op-ed piece by Edmund Phelps, a professor at Columbia University. And he drew a very interesting parallel. I don't know what you think of it. The headline given to this piece was Crash, Bang, Wallop. And what he was talking about, you may have seen it, was he said, look, if you go back to the Great Depression, you had the crash of 29, you had a bang, a kind of a comeback until 1933, and then nothing. And then the stock market just went dead flat and stayed there flat for years. And he made the case that this could be happening again now. What do you think of the parallel?
Well, I agree with half of it, Tom. I did read the article, and I think basically he was saying that the 1920s were a lot like the 1990s, and the 1930s can give us a forecast of what it's going to be like in the decade we're in right now. I sort of agree with the first part. The 20s were kind of like the 90s. There were a lot of hot new technologies like automobiles and radios, electrical technologies, the movies and so on. In the 1990s, we had our computers and the internet. So, you know, there are very close similarities there. But from 29 to 33, which might correspond to 1999 to, you know, last year, we had the worst depression in American history. And as Jeremy pointed out earlier, you know, the recession that we had was barely noticeable in the last couple of years back there in 2001. And so there's a big difference there. And my view is that, you know, I disagree with Ned Phelps on the 1930s versus this decade. It seems to me that probably the economy is going to do better in this decade than the stock market did. You know, he pointed out that the stock market rallied a lot after the lows of 1932-33. My guess is that the economy is probably going to do better, and unemployment's a lot lower now than it was in the 1930s. even if it's not as low as we want it to be. But the stock market is, and we haven't talked about this yet, fairly richly valued by historical norms. And so my guess is, unlike the 1930s when the stock market maybe did a little better than the economy, I'm suspecting that this decade may be one where the economy does a little better than the stock market.
Well, are you saying then that, in fact, the market might sort of go flatline at the point we're at now? Is that what you're suggesting?
I've studied the 200 years, as has Jeremy, of U.S. stock prices, and it seems like when you get to the sort of very high peaks like we had in 1999 and 1929, and there's a few other times, the decade or so following those peaks has not been very good, and therefore I wouldn't be surprised if this year may be all right, maybe next year won't be so great. But I'm guessing that the stock market for the next few years is not going to be anything to write home about. Won't be a disaster. And, you know, if you get 5% or 6% a year in the stock market, you're doing a lot better than you would be with 1% in a money market fund.
That's for sure.
So, but I don't think we're going to see these double-digit gains year after year like we got used to in the 90s.
Jeremy Siegel, crash, bang, wallop?
I agree with Richard. From 1929-1933, we had a one-third fall of our economy measured by GDP. It took us many, many years to get back to 29. We are already now higher on GDP than we were in the peak of 2000. Back in the 30s, we had unemployment of 25% to 30%. And certainly not without belittling the fact that our unemployment rate is, 5.7 now. It doesn't compare.
A profound difference.
Yeah, I mean, these are just orders of magnitude different. How we suffered in the 30s, indelible impression that left with us. And I respect Ed as an economist, and I know him, but I really don't think that economically we are anywhere near the situation of the 30s. And in fact, just all the data from the last 2 or 3 years, I think, confirms that.
So in the balance of this decade, do you see more robust growth than Richard Cilla? He's saying maybe 5, 6% neighborhood. Do you see something more than that?
Well, he's talking about here in growth in the market. I think I'm a little bit more optimistic. I tend to think we might get 7 to 8 percent returns on stocks, and I agree with him that the double-digit type of returns that we got for nearly 20 years from the early 80s until the top of the boom are extraordinarily unlikely.
Enjoy this last year, folks.
Yeah,
because you may not
we'll have them. I mean, we're going to have some negative and positive.
We
know about the market is
it's up and
from
down.
Year to year, it certainly fluctuates a lot. But if you do get 6, 7, 8% right now, as Richard said, money markets are 1. If you want to go into government bonds, they're 4 to 5. Real estate is high now, and I think when interest rates start rising, as I think they will in the second half of this year, I think that market's going to go flat. So really, there's not a lot of cheap assets around to pick up at a bargain.
Jeremy Siegel wrote Stocks for the Long Run, and he's sticking with it. Professor Siegel, Professor Cilla, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Greg is calling from Manchester, Iowa. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
How you doing?
Just great, thanks.
Well, I'm calling. You wanted to know if there's anyone around that was out of the stock market and got back in for one reason or another. And,
we guess there must be. Are you one of them, Greg?
Well, and as a matter of fact, I am, yes. About 6 years ago, I had done very nicely in some investments, and I called my stockbroker and told him that, I think I'd like to sit on the side for a while. And he says, well, you're in it for the long run, though. I says, well, yeah, I'm not going to get out of investing completely, but I've made enough money here. I don't, let's move it to a money market.
So, Greg, are you tuning your horn here tonight saying you missed the bust and now you're coming back in happy? When did you get back in the market, Greg?
Well, about a year ago.
So your timing has been pretty good. Lucky you. Are you still confident? Are you staying in? Are you putting more money in now?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am, yes, and here's the thing. My sleep level has never been more comfortable than it has in the last year. And when I went back into the stock market, I called my stockbroker and asked him that I would, or told him that I would like to buy some stocks from some companies that had declared bankruptcy. And he says, "Well, we're not gonna handle those stocks." I says, "You mean you're not gonna sell me WorldCom and McLeod and so on?"
Right, right.
No, and I hung up on him.
So you're looking for a rebound play, and maybe you found it. Greg, thanks for your call. Richard Cilla, there's the gut check in Iowa that's sleeping very well these days.
Well, I admire our friend in Iowa because I think he was smart back, he said, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. That would have been 1998. I think that was a good time to move some money, maybe not all of it, but some money. You should probably never go all in or all out,
mm-hmm.
but it was a good time in 1998 to take some money off the table and put it into a money market fund. Probably, you know, I think he was a good idea for him a year or so ago to put some money back in because the stocks were a lot cheaper
yeah.
then.
Well, he's
so
wise or he's lucky, but he played it well. Maria's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Maria, you're on the air. Oh, Marla, I'm sorry, Marla.
Hello?
Hello, Marla, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm listening, and you're talking about a very funny world. I'd like to know who was included in this economy? And let me tell you why.
Yeah.
I'm listening to how wonderful everything is. I grew up in Dorchester. I grew up at a time when the city would throw, in the Depression, the city would throw big celebrations 3 or 4 times a year for residents free. We had all the textbooks and pencils and paper and paint and everything that we needed in the public schools. Today, public schools, even in some wealthy suburbs, are having problems with providing enough resources for the kids.
So the champagne
and
corks are not popping all over, right?
And let me say one other thing. I don't remember ever any states canceling primaries because they were too expensive. So what I want to know is, what's this stock market doing for America?
Yeah, Marla, it's the question that we heard Democrats ask just last night again in their debate. Thanks for your call. Jeremy Siegel, how about it? John Edwards says Wall Street and Main Street don't meet up anymore. Marla says that's the way it looks to her. What do you say?
Well, you know, I think what Marla was saying, we're hooking up to a little bit with what Greg Ipp was talking about earlier on your show, is we have a dramatic transformation of our economy. We're moving towards a knowledge-based economy, service-based economy. The factory jobs, and they were very good factory jobs, are leaving, and from many of these towns. And oftentimes, you know, you read about Main Streets, you know, going black, and in some of the, you know, heartland areas disappearing. And I think this transformation is very, very painful. The truth is, it's actually happening in every major country of the world that is developed. That I've studied, Europe and Japan are beginning to suffer the same thing. I think it is global forces here that are transforming and changing our economy that I don't think one can really reverse. And I think when we think about the economy and the stock market, we have to think about global markets. Only one-third of the world's capital is really even in the United States.
Jeremy Siegel, hold the thought. We've got to look more at this. Richard Cilla, we'll be right back. We're talking about that hot market. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the surging stock market and the U.S. economic outlook in a hot election year. My guests are Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance, University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and Richard Cilla, professor of economics at NYU's Stern School of Business. You can join the conversation. Are you back on the stock market bandwagon? Do Wall Street and Main Street intersect these days? Or are the Democrats right when they charge Main Street has been left out of the party? Does the stock market matter to you? Or are you on the outside looking in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeremy Siegel, I want to see if I can understand exactly what you mean. if you're saying that the stock markets, due to global economic dynamics, are kind of uncoupled from portions of the populations in the nations where they're based, then what about the market as an indicator of national economic health? Is it still core? Is it still a critical indicator?
Well, I think it indicates global conditions as well as domestic conditions. You know, the value of those industrial stocks, you know, the General Motors, the U.S. Steel, these used to be the biggest stocks. They used to be most of the market. Today, they're a tiny fraction of it. And in fact, the most investors ignore those stocks. They're not considered important anymore. They're losing steam in the U.S. economy.
But did I hear you suggesting, Jeremy Siegel, that the stock market could go up robustly and still portions of the population wouldn't be feeling a benefit because of a global economic change? Did I hear you right or not?
Well, to some extent, for those jobs that are migrating away, most certainly. Of course, I mean, I think we are all getting the benefit of imports and cheaper imports from around the world. That's one of the factors in driving income in our system. So, you know, indirectly, when we buy consumer goods and, you know, we know that many of them are made abroad, we are getting the benefits of that globalization. But for the loss of the jobs, the loss of the factory jobs, the industrial jobs, that segment of the economy certainly is suffering. And the question is, can the service sector rise with enough jobs like it did in the 90s, more than enough jobs? Mm-hmm. You know, we created almost 8 jobs on the service sector for every job we lost on the factory side. We have not been doing that over the last 2 or 3 years.
And it finally began to work in the 90s, just toward the end, where wages at the bottom were coming up. Richard Cilla, what about, let's say, Senator John Edwards' critique? You know, he makes his Two Americas speech all over the country, and he says there's one America that does the work, another America that reaps the reward. In the context of this stock run-up, do you see truth in that or not?
Well, I think there is some truth in it. I'm not sure that we can do that much about it. That would be a good thing to do. Let's take an example. Suppose an American is earning, you know, $20 an hour in a job, and somebody in India can do that job at $2 an hour. So then the American company hiring that worker says, well, we'll lay off the $20 American worker and hire the $2 an hour Indian worker. For every hour of work, the profits of the company may go up by $18, and therefore the stock of the company would rise. But in the end, the benefit of that rise is goes to the investor in America, but the worker's out of a job, and somebody in India has taken his job.
So the market kind of floats away from that average worker. I want to get some more of our callers in. They've been waiting patiently. Eric is calling from New Ipswich, New Hampshire. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi there. Good evening.
Hi.
I'm not in the financial markets. I'm a software engineer.
Okay.
And I find lots of times that people in finance or economics talk as though we all understand what they're talking about, just as I wouldn't expect someone to understand about discrete data structures.
Right, right, right.
So my basic question is, how do we measure economic growth? We say that the economy is growing, the numbers look good. And on the other side of the coin, we have jobless growth, we have wage stagnation. So how do we measure the economy?
All right. Well, we'll take it as simple as that and put it up against the job question you've embedded there, really. Jeremy Siegel, very straightforward question.
Well, there's two ways to measure it. One is when we look at these aggregate statistics like GDP, you know, total output. But that masks what's going on underneath it, which has to do with the distribution of income. You know, again, what Greg Ipp is saying, is it getting more uneven, less uneven? Why? What are the factors there? So, you know, there's two ways to measure that. And, you know, in the past, looking at the growth of what we call per capita income is universally considered the standard of living around the country, around the world, between countries. But, you know, one of the things we also have to look at is what's happening to the distribution of income within countries. And I think, you know, again, what the Democrats are kind of looking at that is, you know, have the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. I mean, that I think they're trying to make that division. I don't know. I mean, you know, most of the, you know, we still We still have 95% of our labor force employed, you know, and most people on surveys are satisfied with their job, and most people, you know, see progress ahead. So there is an optimism. It seems like the Democrats are having a hard time really making a lot of inroads with this issue among the general population.
I've got to get to some fundamental questions here then, because we've had plenty of guests in recent weeks. Stephen Roach was Morgan Stanley's chief economist. Robert Rubin was with us. George Akerlof not long ago. All of these guys painting a kind of scary picture of, first of all, the twin deficits, the big federal budget deficit and the huge trade deficit, and raising an alarm and saying this is unsustainable. How is it, Richard Silla, that the stock market can be going up into the teeth of these conditions that plenty of big economic observers are saying just don't add up?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that there may be some longer-run problems in terms of our deficits.
But isn't the market supposed to be forward-looking? Are you saying the market's saying those problems are so far in the future that it doesn't have to worry about them now?
Well, I live in New York, and I know a lot of people on Wall Street, and, you know, they think that 5 minutes is a long time from now. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, you know, what they're telling their customers, and their customers may be acting on it, is that the outlook for the economy this year is good, and therefore you can expect to make money in stocks this year. And even a famous economist, Lord Keynes, said in the long run we're all dead. So if this year is the place to be in the stock market, people are going to go in.
But I heard you saying 5 or 6% growth maybe through the rest of the decade, Jeremy Siegel saying higher. How does that jibe with, let's say interest rates are supposed to go back up, presumably. The dollar's been down. All these pressures that could converge on the market, and yet the market seems to slough them off.
That's right, and I think but interest rates being as low as they are now are one of the props under the stock market, and of course they're one of the props under the economy.
But what about the anticipation of higher rates? That should be factoring in here too, shouldn't it?
I think that Jeremy said that later this year he expects the interest rates to rise. About a year ago, I thought that interest rates would be higher now than they were then. I turned out to be wrong. But I do believe that the interest rates are about as low as they can go. Mm. They're going to go up, and the only question is when. And when they do go up, it's not going to be the best news for the stock market.
Still, Jeremy Siegel, we've just got a minute left. Robert Rubin was with us. He's kind of got his concern level pinned in the red zone, it sounded like, recently. You're saying, hey, it's going to be all right. What's the difference in perspective here?
Well, one of the things, I mean, you know, already the government budget deficit for this year has been lowered by about $90 billion by the CBO looked on economic growth being stronger. So much of these data depend on how strong economic growth is. The drop in the dollar will help our trade deficit. The last numbers were better. It may have to drop further, definitely to help on that situation. But I don't see those two numbers as really being unmanageable in the sense that they, you know, severely threaten the long-term outlook for our economy or really our financial markets.
Well, there we've got two votes of optimism tonight in the market, one a little higher pitched than the other, but still both saying, hey, this is the place to be. I want to thank you both for your perspective tonight. Jeremy Siegel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, author of Stocks for the Long Run, and Richard Silla, thank you for being with us tonight.
Tom, thanks much. I enjoyed being here.
Great having you. Richard Silla joined us from Tucson, Arizona. He's professor of economics at NYU's Stern School of Business. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, what it feels like to be a voter in New Hampshire, days before the nation's first primary. This is On Point. With the nation's first primary just 4 days away now, presidential candidates are everywhere in New Hampshire. John Kerry visited Derry, Merrimack, and Manchester today. Howard Dean hit Londonderry, Nashua, and Keene. Joe Lieberman spoke in Manchester and Concord before a downtown stroll through Portsmouth. New Hampshire resident Sarah Ream says it's hard to step outside in New Hampshire without running into a candidate these days. In this radio diary, she says there's something nice about being, however briefly, the center of the political universe.
As a middle-aged prep school teacher in New Hampshire, I was surprised the other day to feel a sense of connection to one particular Southern belle. Kids in my dorm were watching Gone with the Wind in the common room. I trudged by, arms full of firewood, muck boots flapping, to see Vivian Leigh in yards of organza, surrounded by devoted beaux. "Well, let me see. She purred. "Why, I do believe Mr. Charles Hamilton shall bring me my barbecue." Off dashed the youth, aglow with victory, to do Miss Scarlett's bidding. "I am a Democrat in New Hampshire on the eve of the primary, and the beaux have come a-courtin'. Who will win my hand? It's not that I mind being wooed. Who would? It's just that the dynamics are a little more complicated than might at first appear. I admire the brashness of the candidate's approach. They make their desires plain. In various ways, they plight their troth, and, like impatient suitors, press for tokens in return. I consider a bumper sticker, and they urge a yard sign. I agree to a campaign button, and wind up with a cap and T-shirt. I acquiesce to a meetup, and find myself in a focus group. I must display my keepsakes for all to see. Hold on, I murmur. Not so fast. I feel like the girl whose daddy owns the football team, the supermodel with endless legs, the Southern Belle from land that will one day be hers. I am, for a brief and heady time, the link to what they each most desire. The pursuit is so uniformly obvious that I can't help but notice it's not my opinion they want, but by accident of geography and timing, my vote. Every 4 years, I prove irresistible to politicians. Perhaps the sad fact is that actually, I quite enjoy this too, and it makes me feel shallow and glib. A kick-up-my-heels political party animal. Who will ask me for the next dance? After all, do I really mind their noticing my political assets? Indeed, what's the alternative? Would I rather have these fellows lounging in Washington, strategizing away and making me nothing more than a thumbtack on the big campaign wall map? Hardly. But such public courtship inevitably involves the paparazzi. The other day I made plans to have coffee with an old friend. "Oh, let's stay out of downtown," I moaned. "Joe Lieberman's going to be working the lunch counters there." I spied news cameras filling sidewalks outside of the rest home where Howard Dean had been speaking. I threw up my snorkel hood to avoid chic cosmopolitan reporters wanting my simple New Hampshire views. The day John Kerry served up chili at our fire station, I made a mental note to make sure my cat stayed out of the tree. When rumors ran rife that Wesley Clark would be shopping at the local supermarket, could anyone blame me for zipping over to the rival grocery for a loaf of bread between classes? And when John Edwards showed up to speak at town hall on the day that it was 40 below, I planned to go so that he wouldn't be alone, but minus 40 will tax anyone's sense of hospitality. I stayed inside instead and dodged phone calls from the Gephardt and Kucinich guys. A lovesick teenager or a deranged stalker is not more fervent on the phone than a campaign staffer. Basically, it seems that at this time of year, one needs to plan how not to run into political candidates and their people all over town and in one's home. One day soon it will, of course, come to an end. The paparazzi will depart, and my sunglasses will go back in their case until summer. The day after the primary, life will return to normal, and our status as political Cinderellas will vanish like the coach and four at midnight. But by then, perhaps, I will have dodged and weaved through enough political canvassing to make up my mind and bestow my hand on just one suitor.
Sarah Rehm is chair of the drama department at Phillips Exeter Academy. She lives in Exeter, New Hampshire. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.